Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on this mid-March Sunday afternoon. No question about it, a lot that happens in this country is determined by what goes on in the United States Congress, and the vast majority of that is uncovered in the news media and unknown to the American public. Today, we're going to have one of the shining lights in the U.S. Congress, one of the beacons and one of the champions of the public interest, and also one of the leaders in fighting for a free press and for democratic media policymaking. Our guest today on Media Matters, U.S. Representative Bernie Sanders from the state of Vermont. So join us for the show, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
A gaggle of FCC watchers and public interest advocates filed a petition with the agency on March 9th calling for a freeze in the processing of applications filed in 2003 for FM translator stations. FM translators are low-power radio stations whose exclusive duty is to rebroadcast another signal. In the 2003 filing window, more than 13,000 translator applications came in, of which a third were filed by several shadow corporations established by just three people. Those people appear to be engaged in a scheme of spectrum speculation and trafficking, selling station construction permits for a profit, $800,000 and counting so far. Harold Feld, senior vice president of the Media Access Project, says the FCC could do many things to remedy the situation.
It could cancel the licenses that it issued. Instead, the licenses were obtained by fraud. The commission could demand that the parties either agree to pay a fine to the federal government equal to the amount of money that they made through the illegal trafficking scheme, or face other punishment for violation of the commission's rules.
What makes this particular scheme so egregious is that the speculators, doing business as Edgewater Broadcasting, Radio Assist Ministry, and World Radio Link, are pursuing profit at the expense of real local community radio and claiming a false morality in the process.
I fully expect that these three individuals are going to complain that this is, you know, the attack of left-wing secular humanists. But nobody should argue that you can put together three dummy companies, get free federal licenses, and then turn around and sell them for hundreds of thousands of dollars of pure profit. I mean, that's just wrong.
A lowball estimate suggests the speculation scheme has netted those behind it more than $5 million worth of public spectrum to date. The largest buyers of stations in the scheme are Calvary Chapel Churches in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and San Diego, California, which collectively have spent more than $500,000 for about four dozen FM stations in four states.
On Thursday, March 10th, the Federal Communications Commission approved allocating a new 50 megahertz of spectrum for the development of wireless broadband networks. This allocation calls for a mixture of licensed and unlicensed wireless activity, something Commissioner Michael Copps thinks will help satisfy the growing demand for wireless networking.
I think entrepreneurial and municipal and mesh networks should get a real boost from this approach.
However, the fine points of the new policy, like guaranteeing equal access between licensed and unlicensed wireless users, remains to be written. Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein says this point will be critical, and if it's handled correctly, it could mean expanding the reach of broadband data services dramatically.
This should make it easier to get spectrum in the hands of people who are ready and willing to use it, and will certainly present new opportunities for rural broadband deployment.
The spectrum in question was traditionally reserved for satellite uplinks and downlinks, but in the majority of the United States, it is not used.
The second National Conference for Media Reform takes place in St. Louis from May 13th through the 15th. The first conference was held in Madison, Wisconsin in late 2003 and attracted close to 2,000 people. The St. Louis gathering is expected to be even larger, bringing media policymakers, academics, journalists, and activists together to strategize on ways to make sure lawmakers and regulators keep the public interest in mind on media matters. Conference co-director Yolanda Hippensteel says one major goal is to demystify the policy landscape and gird for big skirmishes on the horizon.
We're looking right now at a time in media policy that is going to shape whether tomorrow's media is better than today's. We've got policies on tap, including the revision of the Telecommunications Act, which we'll see coming up again in 2005.
Once people understand the stakes, the next step is to show them how to get engaged in policy activism. Hippensteel says there's lots of ways to do that, all of which will be reviewed at the conference.
From challenging broadcast license renewals for your local TV or radio station, or trying to win community media through cable franchise license renewals, lobbying your members of Congress to be sure that they're voting the right way on key media policy at the federal level.
To learn more, visit freepress.net/conference. Register before the end of March and receive a $50 discount off the price of admission. Reduced rates are also available for students, seniors, and those on low or fixed incomes who otherwise could not afford to attend. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We've got a live show coming to you today, and our guest is one of those guests that really doesn't need much of an introduction, but I'm going to give him one anyway. Congressman Bernie Sanders represents Vermont as the only elected independent in the U.S. House of Representatives, and he's the longest-standing congressional independent in U.S. history. After serving as mayor of Burlington, Vermont from 1981 to 1989, Sanders was first elected to the House in 1990. He is a founder of the Progressive Caucus, a group of 50-plus lawmakers dedicated to advancing economic and social justice, and he is unquestionably the leading single voice on the cause of democratic media against censorship for media reform in the U.S. Congress. Today, it is an honor to welcome Bernie Sanders to Media Matters.
Hey, Bob, it's wonderful to be with you.
Now, I assume you've still recovered from that University of Vermont basketball victory yesterday, Bernie. You can't get elected up there unless you're a fan of the team, right?
I was there.
You were there. All right.
Yes.
Well, Bernie, you actually come from a district that represents the entire state of Vermont, unlike most members of the House who have smaller districts. And before we get started, I just want to talk about something that's sort of a concern a lot of people have that doesn't sort of slips through the cracks of discussion, but is getting a little more attention now, which is gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. You're obviously a seat that can't be gerrymandered.
Unless Vermont merges with Quebec.
Is that something you're working on? Escape valve?
Yes.
Okay. How important of a concern is it that gerrymandering is sort of undermining the popular sovereignty in this nation?
Well, it's a huge issue. I think that relates to the process that's now taking place in Washington, where we have a Congress which is led by right-wing extremists, people like Tom DeLay. And their view is not to hold elections and see whose ideas come out on top, see which candidates win. They work night and day to make sure that their side wins, and if they're prepared to break the rules, so be it. And we see that, Bob, a lot on the floor of the House. Perhaps later we'll talk about the USA Patriot Act. Last summer, I brought forth an amendment that would have amended one of the more egregious sections of the USA Patriot Act. We won the amendment. At the end of regulation time, 17 minutes, we were ahead by 10 votes. DeLay extended the time that members had to vote by another 20 minutes, twisted arms, and we ended up losing on a tie. In terms of gerrymandering, it's kind of the same thing. What some of the Republicans are doing, led by DeLay, and certainly in Texas as an example, is they have control of the state government. They're not happy with the representation that the state has in Washington. They think there are too many non-Republicans. Therefore, they will change the districts in order to make sure that Republicans prevail. Is this something that's dangerous? Of course it is. We have a process in this country by which states are redistricted every 10 years. I believe it's after the census.
Mm-hmm.
That's historically what's been the case, and these guys are changing the rules.
Yeah, and for listeners who might not be too familiar with the gerrymandering, what it means is that you monkey around with the districts for congressional districts so that there aren't any competitive races. And if you're the party in power statewide and control your state government, you can do it. So let's say you're the Democrats, for sake of discussion, and you've got normally get 53% of the votes statewide. You can gerrymander it so you've got 80% of the seats in the House.
Right. And it's very easy. It's easy to do that. You know, which districts tend toward one party, which districts tend toward the other, and instead of making one district 80-20, you make it 60-40, and you take your supporters and you put them elsewhere.
Bernie, there's been a lot happening politically I want to talk about in Washington that you've been dealing with, and a lot on the media front, too. And you've been a leader of the media reform movement in Washington, if not the pioneering leader, really, I would say.
Let me jump in here to say something.
Okay.
I want your listeners to know that the guy at the other end of the phone, Bob McChesney, in my view, is really an American hero. Because the issue of media, for anybody who thinks about this issue for more than 30 seconds, is of huge consequence. And for many years, some of us have wanted to bring that issue to the people, make it into a political issue. If we're concerned about health care, the environment, war and peace, poverty, all important issues, media is as important or more important than all of them. And folks like Bob McChesney, John Nichols, and a few others have really been there year after year, with enormous success, so that now in the Congress, throughout the country, people begin to understand media consolidation, media censorship is a huge issue. And Bob, thank you for all that you've done on this.
Well, thank you, Bernie. That was unexpected and very kind of you. You know, this morning on the New York Times, above the fold front page, a big story on the Bush administration's use of bogus video news releases, trying to pass them off and getting them passed off as legitimate television news stories to promote Bush administration policies paid for with taxpayers' money. What's your thinking? I mean, what is this all about? What can we do about it? What's your sense of it?
All right, let's deal with this in a broad sense. And I applaud the Times for doing a very lengthy report on this. This is part of a pattern in which you have an extreme right-wing administration that understands how important media is, and is working, and, you know, certainly every administration in American history has understood how important media is, but these guys have taken it to a clearly to another level in a number of respects. As we'll talk about later, Bob, and as you were certainly actively involved in, was the whole issue of media consolidation. At a time when the media in this country is owned by fewer and fewer large corporate conglomerates, these guys wanted it to be owned by even fewer, and we'll talk about that in a moment. What we have seen is Bush putting on government payroll so-called media pundits like Armstrong Williams and others actually receiving taxpayer money going on the media where they're supposedly objective, independent minds and really getting paid to push the Bush administration line.
Payola pundits.
Exactly, payola pundits. And several have been exposed, and God only knows how many more are there. We are seeing now in the White House briefing room right-wing extremists who represent virtually a non-media organization being allowed to ask softball questions to the president. We are seeing this, and I want to talk about this in a while, the so-called indecency law.
Which yeah, we'll definitely get to that.
Huge issue. And then on top of that, what we are seeing now is, and the Times reported this, we've known about it, but I think we haven't known the extent about it, is what we're seeing now is the Bush administration and various government agencies actually producing phony video news clips, which many stations are running as quote-unquote news when they're really government propaganda, if you like, about how wonderful the Bush administration is doing on this, that, or the other thing. So this is part of an overall pattern by the Bush administration to control the flow of information in this country, use taxpayer dollars to get their points across to attack dissent. For the first time, or at least never to a degree like this, we're having reporters from the New York Times, elsewhere, threatened with jail because they're refusing to provide information to the government about who their sources are. You add all of that together, and I think we're in a very frightening situation by which the American people have got to launch a major counteroffensive.
We're talking to U.S. Representative Bernie Sanders today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Bernie Sanders is the representative from the state of Vermont. You're in your eighth term now. Is that right, Bernie? And Bernie Sanders is well-known to many of our listeners here. He's been on the show before. He will be in Urbana. Let me alert you, fair listeners. May 10th of this year. He will be giving a keynote address at the conference we're going to be having called Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? Also at the conference, people like Linda Foley, who will be our guest in 2 weeks, Seymour Hersh, Naomi Klein, John Nichols, and a bunch of other terrific people. Bernie will be there with Don Henley, the opening night, giving the opening talk. And we're really looking forward to having you here, Bernie.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Bob.
It's going to be great. That's May 10th. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Bernie Sanders, the phone number here is 333-9455. The toll-free number and the toll-free line is open, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now, Bernie.
Okay.
Line 1, Champaign, you're on the air with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, Congressman Sanders, my name's Francis Boyle. I'm a professor of law here at the University of Illinois. And in light of your previous comment about the American people rising up against Bush, during the past 2 years, several of your constituents have been in to talk with you about introducing a bill of impeachment against President Bush, first for creating a police state here in the United States, and second for his war against Iraq. 2 years ago today, Congressman John Conyers convened an emergency meeting of 40 to 50 of his top advisors, most of whom were lawyers, to debate putting in immediate bills of impeachment to stop that war. And he invited in former Attorney General Ramsey Clark and me to state the case for impeachment. Now, the main problem was not that the advisors there didn't agree that Bush richly deserved to be impeached, but John Podesta said, appearing for the Democratic National Committee, that he believed a bill of impeachment would hurt the Democrats get their presidential candidate elected in 2004. Now, you're a political independent, you're a courageous man, you're a brave man, and you also have a safe seat. So I would respectfully ask you to consider putting in a bill of impeachment against President Bush. There is a revised second draft bill of impeachment right now at Congressman Conyers' office, and I'm happy to serve as your lawyer free of charge to put this in, just as I did for the late, great Congressman Henry B. Gonzalez against Bush Sr.
Yeah.
Your comments, please. Sure.
Well, thank you very much, Francis. I don't agree that a bill of impeachment is a wise thing to do at this point. I think what we need to do is bring the American people together to understand that we have a reactionary right-wing administration working for corporate America and the rich against the middle class and working people. I think from a political perspective, A, obviously, as everybody knows, with Republicans controlling both branches of government, an impeachment process would go nowhere in a hurry. But second of all, from a political perspective, I think, frankly, it would deflect attention from the kinds of movement that we have to build up. So I am working day and night to bring working people together, to bring veterans together, to bring seniors together, to getting all of those people who have been ripped off by this administration together so that we can form a progressive movement in this country to reclaim the Congress, reclaim the White House. But I think in that process, impeachment would be counterproductive, in my view, my political judgment.
Yeah, unfortunately, I lost Professor Boyle just now. But if I can just do a follow-up on that, Bernie, do you think, though, just on the face of it, factually, there is sufficient grounds to warrant impeachment outside of the political possibilities of it getting passed?
Well, this guy is – I'm not a lawyer, so I can't go through all the details. But no question that this administration is way over the top on many areas. But again, my thought, Bob, is from a political perspective, what we have to do is build a movement of people to fight for their rights. And I think that the impeachment effort, I know there are a number of liberals who think it's a good idea. I don't. Let me mention something interesting, which excites me more. And I don't know how much it has gotten out into the media, which is interesting unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar, Bob, with the newspaper Stars and Stripes?
Sure.
This is the military newspaper that goes out to our soldiers. Last week, they ran an article in which it turned out that at a meeting of the Veterans Committee at the House of Representatives, hundreds of veterans from the DAV, Disabled American Veterans, stood up and cheered people like progressive Democrat Bob Filner, who took on the Republican leadership in terms of the horrendous policies they're developing toward our veterans. And when the Republican chair tried to respond, they booed him down. It was a very good article, and Bob Filner did a great job. But my point there is, to build a political movement, we have to reach out to a wide group of constituents, including veterans, including conservatives, among other things, who are outraged by the attacks on civil liberties that the Bush administration is putting forward. So, to me, that is the effort that I am involved in, and I think impeachment in that sense is counterproductive.
We're talking to Bernie Sanders, U.S. Representative from Vermont today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone lines here are open. The number is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Bernie Sanders, you are an independent. You are not a Republican or a Democrat. You are also arguably the most progressive member of the House, or one of the most progressive, and certainly in the front group. And now the Democratic Party is going through a period of sort of reappraisal of what its future is going to be after coming off the 2004 presidential loss. Howard Dean, your fellow Vermonter, is now running the Democratic Party. What is the advice you would give Howard Dean if you could, and do you think he'd take it?
Well, obviously, I've known Howard Dean for many, many years. And while when he was governor of Vermont, he was rather a moderate fellow and in some cases kind of conservative, I think in the last few years he has played a good role in a couple of respects. He had a lot of guts standing up to Bush when a lot of people were not. And also he has shown us how powerful a tool the Internet can be. The problem, obviously, the longstanding problem with the Democratic Party is that there are a lot of people in that party who are much more respondent to the needs of big money and corporate interests than they are to the working people. And I think the Democrats have ultimately got to decide which side they are on. I think poll after poll indicates that the average American worker is not quite sure whether the Democrats stand with them or not, and for a lot of good reasons. For example, in terms of trade policy, it was, let us not forget, Bill Clinton who gave us NAFTA, Bill Clinton who gave us permanent normal trade relations with China, part of a disastrous overall trade policy, which is causing the loss of millions of good-paying jobs, lowering wages, increasing the gap between the rich and the poor. That's Bill Clinton. And the Democrats still haven't decided very clearly which side they're on that issue. What Dean is doing, which is right, is trying to move the party from a party dominated by money and contributors to a grassroots-type effort. I think the fact that he's going to college campuses all over this country, apparently drawing large crowds, is exactly the right thing to do. Create a contributor base, which is based on folks who contribute $10, $20, $50 rather than thousands of dollars. I think that's the right thing to do. But ultimately, I think the crisis of our time is that working people, lower-income people, are very distant and alienated from both political parties, and that they don't see either party vigorously standing up for their economic interest. We are the only country in the industrialized world that does not have a national health care program which guarantees health care to all people, and yet we spend twice as much per person on health care as any other country. How many folks do you see in the Democratic Party say, hey, we got to take on the drug companies, the insurance companies, and we have to move toward a national health care program? Health care is a right of all people. We can guarantee health care to all people for less money than we're spending today. You don't see too many people doing that. You saw John Kerry saying, well, I want health care for all children. Well, that's easy because it's relatively inexpensive. Do we see Kerry prepared to take on big health care? To some degree. Did he go far enough? No. I mentioned trade. I think trade is a huge issue, huge issue. And the reality is we're working on a report on this right now, Bob. Mm-hmm. And we have statements from corporate leader after corporate leader who are making it very, very clear that they are prepared tomorrow or yesterday, they've already gone, to China, pay people there 30 cents an hour, and throw American workers out on the street. How many people in the Democratic Party are prepared to say to the head of General Electric, heads of IBM, hey, you're investing billions of dollars in China where people can't form a union, they go to jail if they protest environmental regulations. What about investing some money in America so we can create decent jobs for our kids? Do you see a whole lot of Democrats talking about that issue? You don't. The growing gap between the rich and the poor. You know, we talk about media and what media talks about and what media does not talk about. Man, you tell me the last time you saw a good program on TV, Bob. about the growing gap between the rich and the poor and the decline of the middle class.
It's been a long time. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen one. Except even Bill Moyers was on the air.
Yeah, and Bill Moyers himself had about 50% of all of the good television, one program. That's right, with the exception of Moyers, who did deal with this issue.
You know, Bernie, let me just follow up on one point that you're getting at there, because there was a crucial vote in Congress this past week on a bill that has been pushed for years and years, and they finally got it through concerning bankruptcy revision. The late Paul Wellstone, this was probably the most important issue to him in his career, was fighting efforts to get rid of the bankruptcy protection for poor Americans and middle-class Americans, and now that's basically that fight's been lost. Can you talk a little bit about how the Democratic Party came down on the bankruptcy reform?
Well, that
reform?
Was in the Senate.
Yeah.
And you had, in fact, the number, as I recall, was it 17 or 18 Democrats joining with Republicans?
Yeah.
And that's a clear case in point. Everybody who studies the issue understands that the so-called bankruptcy bill was written by the credit card companies and the banks. And at a time when the middle class is being squeezed, when people are working longer hours for low wages, when health care costs are rising, when there is huge job turnover, when people get divorced, and all of those factors lead to bankruptcy, the vultures at the credit card companies who are charging people in some cases 25-28% interest, they say, oh my God, we're losing all of this money. Let's go after those people. It is a terrible bill. And I will certainly be helping lead the opposition when it comes to the House. But there's a case in point. If 18, I don't have the number in front of me, but if it is 18 or 17 Democrats voting for that, well, what does that tell working people?
Yeah.
I believe, getting back to the trade issue, that you'd be talking to President John Kerry today if Kerry had not voted for that China bill, had not voted for NAFTA, and was prepared to take on corporate America. But that's the problem they have. They can talk appropriately enough about a right-wing, corporately controlled Republican Party, and then people say, excuse me, what about you guys?
We're talking to Representative Bernie Sanders today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show. We've got a full bank of callers, and I promise I'll get to all of you. The number here, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Bernie Sanders will be here in Urbana May 10th of this year to give an evening plenary address with Don Henley and Naomi Klein for the conference. It'll be open and free to the public. Can freedom of the press survive media consolidation? We'll talk a lot more about that in the coming weeks. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, San Francisco, you're on the air with Bernie Sanders.
I just wanted to call and say that all are agreed that increasing media consolidation poses a great danger in our country. But in spite of your good words, sir, I would say that I'm as worried about the consolidation of our political parties. In this last election year, there was a universal support for John Kerry. And even now with the Social Security changes that Bush is proposing, it seems very weak opposition coming from the Democrats. It's as if just even having it on the table is something worth compromising. I don't know. I just wanted to mention that and maybe have you explain what the future is for independence and whether or not Democrats are really prepared to make sure that all people are represented, and that includes independence.
All right, Bernie, you are an independent. So
I am an independent.
No better person to ask than that. You're certainly not carrying water for the Democratic Party.
No, I think anyone who has listened to the last 15 minutes of the show will indicate that I'm not carrying water for the Democratic Party. I think, politics has a lot to do with common sense and not blind ideology. I supported Kerry in the last election because I thought that the reelection of George Bush would be an absolute disaster for this country. That's what I believe, and that's what I believe it is the case. So I don't have to apologize for that. Now, does that mean that I personally always support Democrats? Quite the contrary. A couple of years ago, I supported a third-party progressive running for governor. In fact, I supported a progressive running for governor of the state of Vermont against Howard Dean, who got 10% of the vote. Supported a progressive running for lieutenant governor of the state of Vermont, got 25% of the vote. Support progressive candidates for the legislature in the state of Vermont. So I think what you have got to do is not be blind about this You got to look at the given circumstance. For example, the Green Party nationally, I think, handled themselves very intelligently during the last presidential election. They said, look, we will work hard in those states which are not going to be very close and ask for support, but we're not going to go into those states where we can shift the vote to Bush. And I think that was an intelligent way of looking at it. So I think in terms of progressive third-party politics, you got to look where you're at. You remember some years ago you mentioned Paul Wellstone. There were some people who wanted to run against Wellstone. He was not progressive enough for them. Obviously absurd. On the other hand, there are certain areas where, sure, if you want to run a third-party candidate for Congress, for mayor, for city council, go for it. But you got to look at the circumstance. In terms of the presidential election, not to have supported Kerry, I think, was a mistake. We had to do everything we can to defeat Bush. We have to stay in that approach, you know. So.
We're talking to Bernie Sanders today in Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Are there any possible defenses against gerrymandering, and if so, what are they?
Well, you know, I think ultimately these decisions are going to be made at the state level. What I think that folks back home have got to do is get involved, and it, in fact, is easier to get involved in statewide issues than it is nationally. Frankly, you can have more opinion on your state capitol and your governor and your members of the legislature than you are on Congress and the president. So if there is an effort to unfairly gerrymander a state through the legislative process, get involved in that thing. Let people hear from you. The truth of the matter is, Bob, it's my judgment, maybe some of your listeners will disagree, is that progressives, and I consider myself a progressive, not a liberal, there's a difference between the two, and liberals are not terribly involved as much as they should be in electoral-type governmental activities. People stand up and they go to demonstrations against the war for this, for that, and the other thing, and that's great. I'm not putting that down. But we need that same energy to be focused on what happens in Washington, what happens at people's state capitals and city halls as well.
We're talking to Bernie Sanders. Let's go back to the phone line. Line two, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hello. I wanted to go back to the bankruptcy bill a bit. I'm kind of asking for a logistics lesson. How does it work with the House bill and the Senate bill? How do those two things become one bill? It sounded last week to me like the Senate bill had happened, and therefore these laws will go into effect. And this is something that I see again and again and don't quite understand. I thought there's a great opportunity to explain it.
Okay.
Bernie, just to put us in a broader context, I'm delighted with that question because I think just a little civics lesson in general about how Congress works would be very enlightening for all of us.
Well, it's funny. I'm glad the caller asked that question because I was mayor, as you mentioned, Bob, of the largest city in Vermont for 8 years. And I thought I knew something about the political process. And I went down to Washington in Congress. I really did not know very much, and you learn more every day. Let me take a few minutes. The way it works is the following. A bill is presented, introduced in the Senate or in the House. In this case, the bill was passed in the Senate, a bankruptcy bill. Another bill, which will probably be different, will be presented in the House. Given the Republican control over the House, it will be passed. If there are differences in the bill, they then go to a conference committee between the House and the Senate, where, and here's the interesting thing, they will come out with another bill, which will go back to the House and the Senate, and that will be the final bill that the president will then sign. What people kind of think, and I thought before I went to Washington, is, okay, there's a bill in the House, there's a bill in the Senate, they're going to work out the differences, and that will be the new bill. Yes and no. What we have sometimes seen is in conference committee, they can completely rewrite the bill. Completely rewrite.
Now, who's on this conference committee? How do you get to be, are you allowed to be on that one?
Oh, no. The conference committee is very much controlled by the parties. That's very important. So when you look at what happens in Congress, the debate that you hear on the floor of the House is important. What's passed at the House is important. Debate in the Senate, what's passed in the Senate is important. But keep your eyes on the prize, because what really happens in a conference committee is ultimately the most important thing. For example, on issue after issue where we pass things, what comes to my mind now is travel to Cuba. Okay, we have year after year said that we want in the House, including some conservative Republicans, Let us move toward normalized relations with Cuba. Let Americans travel to Cuba, so forth and so on. Passes a big vote in the House. Goes nowhere in the Senate. Pension reform bills that I passed in the House, simply thrown out. And sometimes the leaders in the House will allow themselves to accept an amendment on the floor of the House. Say, well, we'll accept it because we know we're going to get rid of it in conference committee. So in terms of the bankruptcy bill, bill was passed in the Senate. There'll be probably another bill passed in the House. The conference committee will look at it. And then a new bill will be created, which goes back to the House and the Senate for passage. And the problem is the conference committee works with a great deal of secrecy. Sometimes they work through the night, and people vote on the bill in the morning, and very few people know what's in it. Sometimes weird stuff appears in those bills.
We're talking to U.S. Representative Bernie Sanders from Vermont today on Media Matters. This is a live show. You can call in the number 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. In the next few weeks here on Media Matters, our guest will be next week, P. Sainath, one of the great journalists from India, we just got in town here last week and were able to tape a show with him. Bernie, this is someone you would love. He's a journalist concerned with the effect of neoliberal economic policies on the poor people of India, and really one of the outstanding journalists of our times, won the Amnesty International Human Rights Journalism Award. 2 weeks from today, we've got Linda Foley, head of the Newspaper Guild, as our guest. And 3 weeks from today, we've got Seymour Hersh, the legendary journalist, who will also both Linda and Seymour Hersh will be in Urbana in May with Bernie Sanders at that conference that we'll be talking about in the coming weeks. Let's go back to the phone lines now. We've got Line 3, Urbana. You're on the air with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, you're such a great source of info on how Congress works. But I got a question that you might not be able to give a good answer to. If you're in a conservative district and you're a progressive, is there any way to put a little heat on that congressman? Or
is this a hypothetical question, caller?
Actually, no.
Here's the story. Okay, first of all, let me give you my political judgment. I think you should get rid of these judgments about conservative and liberal. I think they're no longer terribly relevant. Look at things from an economic and class perspective. And what you'll find is that many, quote-unquote, liberals do not stand up for working people. They may be very good on environmental issues, women's issues, gay issues, anti-Bush in general, fine. But on the economic issues, they're not sometimes quite so good. For example, as I mentioned earlier, I think that the trade issue, of which we have a $617 billion trade, we're losing jobs, wages are going down, is a huge issue. Liberals are not particularly great on this issue. I have a bill that would repeal permanent normalized trade relations with China. We have about 70 co-sponsors. 50 of them, in fact, are Democrats, including many good, excellent progressive Democrats. About 18 or 19 of them are Republicans, very, very conservative Republicans. When you think politically, in my judgment, what you should be thinking about is how do we bring people together, ordinary people, not just quote-unquote liberals, ordinary people, to oppose the Bush agenda. And that's why I'm not a great fan of impeachment. I think that's counterproductive. Let me give you some examples, okay? As I mentioned earlier, there are millions of veterans who served their country who now want to get into a VA hospital where they had been promised VA benefits. They want VA health care. Promises have been made to them. Bush is coming up with a health care budget for veterans, which is an outrage. The American Legion, the VFW, the Disabled American Veterans, speaking out against this Bush budget as a sellout of veterans. So we should be working with veterans and veterans organizations. This is primarily a conservative issue. So if you are in a conservative district, you speak to your representative with veterans organizations and say, why are you selling out veterans at the same time as you're giving tax breaks to billionaires? Another story. Bob, I was on the Fox television network does not like to talk about the trade issue because they know that most of their constituents, right-wing conservatives, do not like Bush's policy on trade. They made a mistake about a month or so ago. I was on O'Reilly's show, and somebody else was moderating the show that night. We talked about trade. Overwhelming amount of support. Emails came into my office saying, we are conservative Republicans. We strongly disagree with the president's position on trade. Talk about that issue. Go to your quote-unquote conservative and say, why are you selling out American workers and America? why are more and more debt being bought by China and Japan? Because we have a huge national deficit and a trade deficit. Bring people together on that issue. On civil liberties, you know, it's not just progressives, mostly progressives, but not just only progressives, who are voicing opposition to USA Patriot Act, the indecency bill. There are some good conservative organizations out there who believe in small government, do not believe that the FBI should be going into our libraries monitoring our reading habits. Reach out to those guys. So in other words, on many economic issues, you're going to find some of these conservatives not so bad. Work with them.
Yeah, Bernie, you come from Vermont, which has a reputation as being the most liberal/progressive
state. It is not the most liberal.
Well, that has that reputation outside of Vermont.
Yeah, because the media gets it wrong.
So the people say, well, gee, it's easy for you or someone in Madison or Berkeley to tout this sort of stuff, but you know that won't fly in middle America.
All right, good. I'm glad you asked me that.
Yeah, Vermont, that's why I asked you.
Vermont is not a quote-unquote liberal state. City of Burlington, where I was mayor for 8 years, is a liberal city. But there are parts of the – we are the most rural – let's put it in another way. In rural America today, two-thirds of white men in rural America vote Republican. Okay, Vermont happens to be, if not the most rural state in the country. I think half our people live in towns of 500 or more, 500 or less.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it is not a quote-unquote liberal state. What we are is a state where some of us have worked very, very hard for many years to explain issues to ordinary working people so that in communities, rural or we don't have too many urban communities in Vermont, you know, I can get 60, 70, 80% of the vote among working-class people, who in other parts of the country vote conservative.
Now, are these people sometimes splitting the ticket? They'll be voting for Sanders and maybe even voting for a Republican?
Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, the numbers must work that way, actually.
We got 25, 30% of people who voted, maybe even more in certain areas, who voted for Bush, who voted for me.
We're talking to Bernie Sanders today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air.
Yes. On the bankruptcy issue, I continue to be, confused why I should be for bankruptcy protection when people willingly and knowledgeably have borrowed money that they promised to repay, and then because of circumstances that may be dire or unfortunate, still they knew the possibility of those circumstances existed when they went into debt, and why should they be given protection and not have to repay what they borrowed? I'll hang up and listen to your reply.
Yeah, and in fact, it's fair that caller's question, because I think the presentation of the bankruptcy bill has been entirely that. I mean, Bill Frist, the Senate Republican leader, said, hey, this is just about fairness on them. Yep. Some people sneak out of paying their bills.
Right. And that's a fair question. But I think if we look at what we have historically had in this country, what we have said is that when people face dire circumstances, there has to be protection so that they're not wiped out and destroyed completely. And that's what bankruptcy is about. Are there people who abuse the bankruptcy bill, who in fact maybe could pay some of those bills and are choosing not to? The answer is yes. And many of those people, by the way, are wealthy people who hide behind various loopholes and protect their interest and not pay what they're owed. But let's look at another reality. If you look at who is going bankrupt today, is the people who are saying, well, let's see, I'm going to rip off the system, I'm going to buy a boat, big cars, do all of these things, and then, hey, just knock it up, say I'm going bankrupt. The answer is no. What the statistics indicate, that a significant percentage of people who deal with bankruptcy are people who cannot afford, they get ill, they end up in the hospital, they have outrageously high medical bills, and they can't afford to pay them. Should we punish those people? In America today, there is an enormous amount of job loss. People are losing their jobs. They're sometimes getting jobs that pay them 50% of what they previously had. They have two kids. What should we do? Should we destroy their lives economically? There are women who are getting divorced. They've been married. They get a divorce. They end up with very little. They have some kids. Do we destroy them economically? So I think historically what America has been about is to say, no, we've got to protect people who are under dire circumstances. I am not in favor of people ripping off the system, but what you will find from, you know, Frist's position is they will protect day after day after day the wealthy and large corporations who are ripping off our system by billions of dollars and we only provide more subsidies, more tax breaks, more corporate welfare for these guys, but trying to stand up for the middle class, a working class person who has faced difficult circumstances, those are the people we got to go after.
Bernie Sanders, let's go back to an issue we talked about at the top of the show that you wanted to talk about, and I think it's worth bringing up, which is the vote that took place in Congress a couple weeks ago, it's 3 weeks ago now, if I'm not mistaken, about levying enormous fines on broadcasters if they broadcast what's considered indecent or vulgar fare. You gave an eloquent opposition to that vote, and it passed by an overwhelming margin, if I'm not mistaken, in the House. Can you talk a little bit about that issue?
Sure. What the House did was raise the fines very, very substantially. Today they're fairly low for, quote-unquote, acts of indecency. In other words, if I start spewing forth, I say one of your callers asked me a question, I really get angry, and I start spewing forth four-letter words. If this bill were to take place, your station in Urbana could be fined up to $500,000.
Which would put us out of business.
Which would put you out of business.
Yeah.
I received a letter from a Vermont Public Television, which is, you know, reasonably small public television station. And I'm reading, I have the quote right in front of me. He says, the guy who runs, the CEO says, our programming director says the FCC proposals have already made us rule out airing independent films on our Real Independent program. Films by Vermont filmmakers that we would have aired in past years are not being accepted for broadcast now. That's a small TV station in Vermont. I think it speaks for TV stations, radio stations all over this country. If you knew somebody had a habit of being vulgar but had something important to say, you would think twice about bringing them on a small public radio station. To be hit with a $500,000 fine would put you out of business. Now, we're not just talking about small radio and TV stations. Here's something that I want the listeners to appreciate. Saving Private Ryan. Bob, you're familiar with that film, right?
Sure.
I thought it was a great film. I mean, it talked about the hell that took place on D-Day when American soldiers were just being shot down by German troops and so forth and so on. I thought it was a great film. It won 5 Academy Awards. Over 55 ABC, now ABC, not a small little company, ABC affiliates refused to run Saving Private Ryan on Veterans Day last year because there was some, you know, four-letter words, I guess, spewed forth. Because soldiers in the middle of war, I guess, occasionally do not use perfect English. 55 ABC affiliates refused to run that Academy Award-winning picture. Now, if ABC affiliates are afraid to stand up with the FCC, and that's before they raise the fine, think of what's happening. And today, oh, yeah, it's just dirty words, all right, just anti-Howard Stern. Well, what would it be tomorrow? What about somebody who attacks the president? Well, maybe we don't want to hear that indecency as well.
You know, Bernie, as you know better than anyone, a lot of the people who voted for this, these punitive fines on indecency, are the same people who are talking about how awful it is to have the government intervening in the marketplace.
Exactly.
And how do you square that circle?
Well, in fact, when I was on the floor of the House, probably I devoted more time to quoting a very, very good statement from a fellow, I think he was with the Cato Institute, a right-wing guy, who basically said that. He said, yeah, hey, it's tough being a parent today. I don't want my kids to watch all the crap on television, but thank you very much, government commissars. I will make that decision myself. And in fact, right now, there are mechanisms by which parents can block out shows that they don't want their kids to see, which I think is a good idea. But the idea that you'll have some commissars at the FCC screening what every radio and television station puts on the air is an outrage. And today, let me just remind listeners, today it is dirty words, you know, Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction or Howard Stern. Tomorrow it's Bob McChesney or Bernie Sanders or somebody else. It is a bad, bad, bad idea. And for honest conservatives, and there are some, by the way, they are saying this is a bad idea. We have got to bring a coalition together to try to stop this. This is, in my view, a very huge issue and is a very dangerous trend.
We're talking to Bernie Sanders today on Media Matters. We have a few callers who have been very patient. I promise we'll get to all of you before we go off the air. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with Representative Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, hi. First, let me say that for those who wanted a fairly decent understanding of the committee system in the Congress, they ought to get hold of the third volume of Robert Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson, Master of the Senate, and he goes into that fairly thoroughly on how Senate committees operate. And the other two volumes, the first and second volume, of course, give you a good understanding of how the President's administration operates, because this is the way Lyndon Johnson operated, and all those people who supported Lyndon Johnson now support the present president and the Republican administration. I was just curious, getting off the major topic of today, how a guy who was born and raised offshore in Brooklyn gets up to Vermont.
All right, well, thank you, caller.
Well, with a great deal of wisdom, I must say.
Well, how long have you lived up in Vermont, Bernie?
Oh, I came here in 64. So it's been 40 years.
40 years.
Most of my life.
But you still haven't perfected your New England accent, have you? Still got Brooklyn there.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phone lines. Let's see, we've got line two, Urbana. You're on the air with Representative Bernie Sanders. Hello, line two.
Are you waiting for three or two?
No, this is you. You're on. I think you're line two, but go ahead.
All right. My question is, and I might tack something on quickly at the end, Darfur is terrible. The women and children there are just being so brutally treated. It's like we're turning our backs on the Holocaust. I hope that there's some kind of movement towards doing something about that. I'm ashamed. The other thing is, 50% of the families in this country are dysfunctional, which means that single parents frequently cannot control what's on TV because they're not in control themselves, and that's rarely mentioned. Okay? That's all I have to say. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. Bernie, comments?
Well, I think she's right on the first issue, and there are terrible things that are happening there and in other parts of the world, in the United States and the rest of the industrialized world. And the United Nations cannot turn its back. We don't want another Rwanda, et cetera, to take place. In terms, I'm not quite sure what you meant, but the second point, while parents cannot control what their kids see, I don't think that the answer to that is having a few commissars in Washington telling radio and television stations what they can put on the air, especially from a so-called conservative administration who tells us how much they hate the big government and they want to get government off of our backs.
Bernie, let's talk about something that has only come up in passing, interesting enough, in view of the politics of our time, which is the war in Iraq and the occupation now. One of the things that's sort of interesting that's taken place in the last few weeks or maybe even months has been that Iraq has sort of fallen more and more off the radar of debate by liberals and discussion by liberals. I was struck recently watching Bill Maher on television, who was sort of a big Bush critic and very much against the war, now saying he's sort of in favor of the war, now that it's for democracy and helping women out in Iraq. If he thought that was what the original argument was, he probably wouldn't have been against it. Move On has come under a great deal of criticism for sort of phasing out opposition to the war and all its missives. Now it's concentrating largely on Social Security and domestic issues. Is this a good war now? Is finally people waking up to that?
Obviously, everybody wants to see the people of Iraq have more democracy, less democracy, rather than live under a dictatorship. But we can never forget that the president told us that this war, and believe me, I was in rooms with Donald, you know, secret rooms with Donald Rumsfeld, where, you know, we got the briefing that we are fighting, that we have threats of weapons of mass destruction aimed at the United States of America. That's what this war, what the war was sold to us. There were very significant implications that Saddam Hussein was working with Osama bin Laden, that they were allied. None of that was true. And if the president, who you remember originally ran for office by telling us that he did not want to see America being involved all over the world and critical, actually, of Bill Clinton for nation building, I think was the expression. Well, if he said that he wanted to go into the war in Iraq, wanted to go into Iraq to bring forth democracy, we could have had that debate, which I think he would have lost big time. So, no, I think the answer is I opposed the war from the beginning. And I think that that opposition was right. But let me, if I may, segue into another issue, which is interesting. We talk about democracy and freedom. Every person who's listening to this show believes in democracy. They believe in freedom. When you talk about one of the outrages of the media, Bob, one of the things that I will never forget is during the 80s, I was mayor of Burlington at this time,
you remember, of course, the war in Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the war in Good Stuff? We were fighting the Sandinista government. They were just so terrible, so horrible. We had to bring freedom to Nicaragua. We sponsored the Contra War. Thousands of people were killed. The nation was economically damaged, and the Contras and the opposition finally won an election. Do you know what's going on in Nicaragua today after we freed those people? Does anybody know?
No,
does the media write about it anymore?
It's uncovered.
Day after day, when we were fighting the Sandinistas, every single problem, I think it was a front-page story in the papers when a police officer pushed somebody in Nicaragua. Front page, front page, front page. Today, I don't know if there are any media in Nicaragua, American media in Nicaragua. The fact of the matter is enormous amounts of poverty. A couple of years ago, there were some indications that children were starving to death in Nicaragua. You had a president of Nicaragua after the Sandinista who managed to steal over $100 million from that country, which is pretty good because that country has no money at all. I don't even think it got into the papers. We freed the people of Nicaragua. Well, somebody should go back to Nicaragua right now and find out how those freed people are living. But it really, that would be an example where media has completely dropped the ball.
That's a really good point, Bernie Sanders. Bernie, we've only got time for one more caller, so let's get to it right now. Line 3, Farina, you're on the air with Representative Bernie Sanders.
Hi, thank you. My question, how can we get consistent and true information on who is voting for what in Congress and who is writing and sponsoring what? And as for impeachment not working, I was wondering about impeaching the whole Bush gang of war criminals at once.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, I've given my answer. I think that it's a political tactic. It is. You know, when we think about politics, you got to think about how do you win? Not just, this is a great idea. These are bad guys. Let's do this. How do you put together a movement of people that will do what we want to see happen? And I think impeachment in that sense is not a good tactic. Let me mention my website, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
We have one of the better websites in Congress. It's www.bernie.house.gov.
In fact, you don't even need the W's. Just bernie.house.gov will get you there.
There you go. And it has a lot of information, not only on Bob's favorite subject, media, but on the USA Patriot Act, Iraq, and many, many economic issues that I think would be of interest to the listeners. So we'd love you to visit us.
Bernie, we've only got about a minute and a half left, and I wanted to give you a chance just to talk about, to give a heads up for our listeners on what you think the big issues before Congress that they should be paying attention to in the next 6 months might be.
Well, obviously, Social Security is a huge issue. And by the way, I think on that issue, the Democrats are trying to fight back. I've been critical of them, but I think on that issue, they're prepared to stand up and fight. And the significance of Social Security and Bush's effort to privatize it and destroy it goes beyond Social Security. It speaks to their social Darwinism, their belief that in America we should not come together to protect each and every one of us, the elderly, the poor, the young, the sick. What they want to do is destroy the ability of the government to protect the American people, transfer powers not only in Social Security but in Medicare, Medicaid, the Veterans Administration, public education, air traffic control, as you name it, postal service, over to corporate America. So this is a huge fight, not only about Social Security, about what kind of country we are going to be. Are we going to protect the weak, the vulnerable? Are we going to protect the middle class? Or do we give power, in this case, over to Wall Street and to corporate America? So I hope people will pay attention to that issue. The fight for a national health care program continues. Our current health care system is disintegrating.
Bernie, on that note, I hear the band tuning up, which means they're trying to clear me out of the studio.
Okay.
I want to thank U.S. Representative Bernie Sanders from Vermont for joining us today on Media Matters. Bernie, as always, has been terrific, and I'll be back 1 week from today with P. Saineth. Please join us then. I want to thank Victor Picard, as always, for his terrific work as producer for Media Matters. Farewell, listeners, for 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
this afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with the high in the mid-30s and north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with the low around 18 degrees and east winds around 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the high in the lower 40s and west winds up to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with the low in the lower 20s and north winds up to 5 miles per hour, shifting to the east after midnight. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.